Wednesday, April 23rd. Widely regarded as one of the foremost songwriters of her generation, Suzanne Vega emerged as a leading figure of the folk revival of the early 1980s. Since the release of her self-titled, critically acclaimed 1985 debut album, she has been known for performances that convey deep emotion, and on this current tour, she is reaching into her catalog to play hits and cover songs by Lou Reed, Duncan Sheik, and others. True Endeavors presents Suzanne Vega Old Songs, New Songs, and Other Songs Tour at the Barrymore on Tuesday, April 23rd at 7:30 p.m. More information at barrymorelive.com. Live music lives at WORT.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The mayor of the northern Ukrainian city of Chernihiv says at least 14 people have been killed in a daytime Russian missile attack. He said more than 60 others have been injured. Danny Eberhard reports.
The missiles hit Chernihiv, a city only some 70 kilometres from the Russian border, in the morning. Video posted online shows residents having to dive for cover on the side of a road as one strike comes in. Officials say a high-rise building was destroyed and others damaged, including a hospital and a higher education institute. Rescuers have been trying to free survivors from the rubble. President Zelensky has said the destruction wouldn't have taken place if Ukraine had enough air defense equipment. With some US Republicans still blocking further military aid, Kyiv is facing acute shortages of air defense systems and missiles.
The British Foreign Secretary says it's clear that Israel has decided to retaliate against last weekend's missile and drone attack by Iran. David Cameron and his German counterpart have been meeting Israeli leaders in Jerusalem to urge restraint. The Israeli Prime Minister thanked them for their support, but said Israel would make its own decisions. Here's James Landale.
In his conversations with Israeli leaders, including the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Lord Cameron's message was one of restraint. The Foreign Secretary said Israel's leadership is clearly making a decision to act in response to the Iranian attack. He said he hoped Israel could be smart as well as tough and do as little as possible to escalate the conflict. Lord Cameron also raised the situation in Gaza, where the humanitarian crisis is still dire, urging Israel to let aid in, while also appealing to Hamas to release Israeli hostages and accept what he called a good ceasefire deal.
President Biden is considering a big increase in tariffs on imports of Chinese steel and aluminium as the US presidential election campaign intensifies. He'll tell unions representing steel workers in Pennsylvania that he wants the current tariffs to be tripled. Jonathan Josephs reports.
President Biden says having a viable steel and aluminium industry is crucial, and cheap Chinese products are a threat to its existence, as well as being more polluting. Further tariffs could be imposed because of an investigation into supposedly unfair Chinese practices in the shipbuilding, maritime, and logistics sectors. This is an effort to look tough on trade in the presidential election campaign against Donald Trump, who has also called for more tariffs on Chinese products. Beijing has repeatedly voiced objections to tariffs, saying they harm the global economy.
Authorities across the United Arab Emirates are clearing up after what the government has described as the heaviest rainfall in 75 years. Many flights at Dubai International Airport, one of the world's busiest, continue to be delayed or disrupted. BBC News.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for two open participating member seats and one open listener sponsor seat to serve three-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
Support for this program comes from Orange Tree Imports, locally owned at 1721 Monroe Street in Madison for almost 50 years. Orange Tree Imports offers a wide array of gifts and kitchenware, including cookware, toys, specialty foods, and Wisconsin products. Information and store hours are available at orangetreeimports.com.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 17th, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Ann Katz. Ann Katz is the executive director of Create Wisconsin. Create Wisconsin advocates, serves, and promotes the state's creative people, industries, and communities as essential to Wisconsin's success. And Create Wisconsin is a member agency of Community Shares Wisconsin, so stay tuned to hear from Ann Katz about Create Wisconsin's work. Also, I'll be speaking with Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott. She is a senior counsel in the Brennan Center for Justice Judiciary Program, where she works to realize a fair and inclusive judicial system that protects fundamental rights, democratic values, and the rule of law. And we're going to be talking about the need for judicial diversity and about the treatment of the first Muslim federal appellate nominee, Adil Manghi. She says insinuations during Manghi's confirmation process that Manghi supports Islamic terrorism, along with attacks on his pro bono work, have no place in a society committed to justice and equality and has damaged our institutions. She says questions during the confirmation hearing left an impression that religious and racial stereotypes had hijacked the hearings. And all this could sink the nomination. So stay tuned to hear from Akasha Zimborski-Wolfcott of the Brennan Center. And then later I'll be speaking with Lindsay Koshgarian, Project Director at the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. They fight for a federal budget that prioritizes peace, economic security, and shared prosperity. So each year the National Priorities Project produces a tax receipt that shows where your 2023 income taxes went. So Lindsay Koshgarian will be telling us about how much the average taxpayer, for instance, subsidized corporate contractors in the military budget. So we'll be talking about this year's tax receipt. So stay tuned to the program. We'll be right back.
Music is playing inside my head, over and over and over again, my friend. There's no end to the music.
just passed 10 minutes after 8, and that was just great, Carole King. Hey, thank you, Dave, our music producer and engineer. Hey, joining me is Ann Katz. Ann Katz is the executive director of Create Wisconsin. Create Wisconsin advocates, serves, and promotes the state's creative people, industries, and communities as essential to Wisconsin's success, and they are, I would say. And Create Wisconsin is a member agency of Community Shares of Wisconsin. So, hey, good morning, Anne. It's great to have you on.
Good morning, Jan. How are you?
I am happy. I was just enjoying that music, and now I get to talk with you. So, Anne, for folks who may not be familiar, I know you've been known as Create Wisconsin for a number of years now, but tell folks about your organization, about your history, and we'll start there.
We are a 30-plus year old organization. We've been around since the early 90s when the Wisconsin Arts Board called arts people together from around the state work on a networking, advocacy, service, and development. And Wisconsin has a long history of supporting the arts, of the arts happening from the grassroots on up. And so Create Wisconsin has been extending that idea, the Wisconsin idea, really throughout the state for over 30 years. Create Wisconsin is our fourth name. We started as the Wisconsin Assembly of Local Arts Agencies, and really a network of organizations like Madison Arts Commission, like Dane Arts, and private organizations, nonprofits that do the arts in their communities. And over the years, we've morphed into an advocacy, a real advocacy organization doing assistance and service with a wide variety of organizations, industries, people, et cetera. So we work with local government, we work with nonprofits, we work with for-profits, we work with pretty much everyone who cares about Wisconsin's future.
So, you know, I want to talk about how you do that, but this idea of creative people as being essential to the state's success, essential to our economy, can you talk about the economic impact of arts in Wisconsin and nationally?
Yeah, the basis of our work is really that the arts are essential to the human condition, right? The arts make us human. Humans have been expressing themselves creatively since the beginning of time. So that's why the arts are important. And especially in the 21st century, and especially in the post-pandemic world that we find ourselves in, creativity as a resource is essential. Wisconsin is full of creative people, industries, communities, and people really trying to keep their downtowns vibrant, attract people to live, work, and play in their communities, keep people living there, entrepreneurial efforts. So that creativity is really what is driving Wisconsin. And, you know, we do everything from lobby the legislature to help get more funding, and that's a critical issue, to helping people on the local level, whether it's an artist or whether it's a local government or a nonprofit or a for-profit, figure out how to do their work. And that means that I drive around the state a lot and talk to people, which is really fun. It's mostly listening to people and helping them figure out what to do. And I'm not the one who can tell them what to do. I can help them realize the potential.
We can call that
technical assistance, but it's really having a relationship with other people and figuring out what they're looking for.
And I would say first off that creative work is essential work, that it is. It's priceless, I just imagining a world without it is hard to do. But at the same time, when you have people who want to pursue this kind of work, the Create Wisconsin recognizes that in fact it does have a successful role in our economy, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, over the last 10, 15 years, there's really been an effort to kind of put parameters around or quantify what economic impact means. And the U.S. Department of Commerce says that the arts industries in Wisconsin, which is everything from self-employed artists to graphic design and architecture firms, is an $11.9 billion, I always say billion with a B, dollar industry with over 88,000 jobs, and that's more jobs than the beer, biotech, and papermaking industries in the state. So while we are able to tell a million stories of how people are uncovering their own creativity and how communities are uncovering that, and when you take those stories and pair them with the economic impact, it's a pretty powerful argument. We just have to keep screaming it from the rooftops over and over again. But I think the world is, I mean, the world is definitely changing. Wisconsin no longer makes cars here. We don't make a lot of paper here anymore. We still want to be a manufacturing state, of course, but we also are a state of small businesses and entrepreneurs. And we really, that's what we push. You know, we have amazingly creative people and communities, and that's where our success is.
Now, can you tell our listeners just some of your about some of your programs? I would direct people to your website because there's a whole lot more discussion of the wide range of programs, but tell us about some of your programs.
Well, again, that sort of general technical assistance is one of our major programs, just talking to people and helping them find resources. And of course, it's always about money, but helping them find resources to do their work. We have a fiscal receiver program, which means that we're trying to help people not jump into creating a nonprofit until they're ready for it. And so we offer a service where we help people raise money that way. We have a new and growing regional leader and a kind of regional development program where we're really trying to not only have a statewide focus, of course, but really put effort and resources into our different regions of the state and have the work happen closer to home. We do an advocacy day every year. We are right now in the middle, and that's going to happen next April. While it's budget season, we are right in the middle of Create Wisconsin Month, which is sort of a month where we just pack in as much stuff as we can celebrate and celebrate what's happening around the state. I'm about to embark upon a tour of the state, doing a lot of presentations and workshops and things like that. So, we try to cover the state with as many different resources and programs as we can.
And so in addition to this technical assistance and consulting and training, and I want to direct folks to the website so that you can get more specific information to follow up on research, strategic planning. You also provide, am I reading that correctly, fiscal receivership, right? I think we talked about that in
past. Yeah. Times. You know, again, we definitely encourage the development of nonprofit organizations if that's what makes sense for someone's work and, you know, for the community, because, of course, nonprofits are really all about serving the community need. But what we have found over the years is that sometimes people create the nonprofit but don't have the knowledge or the resources to keep it going. So we try to help people start their efforts by helping them raise money with as fiscal receiver. And then if along the way, when it becomes time to really jump into being a nonprofit or not, people are more prepared with knowing how a business works and how to get the resources they need. So it's a startup program, really. That really what it is. But over the years, we've helped, I think we have about 65 different fiscal receiver projects at the moment.
Yes. And
some are big and some are small, you know, but we work with groups for a period of time and, again, help them learn, help them figure out where the money might be, you know, help them go about doing their work. And at a certain point, then decide if it's time to be more, have more of a structure that they can continue. So I guess a startup program is really the way to describe it.
Right. I think people can have a great program idea, but aren't in a position to get a grant and need somebody to provide that kind of fiscal services. I think that's startup essential. I think it's really important. And
yeah, we've really, and the, you know, I live in Madison, but we work everywhere in the state, and we've really worked with that kind of startup and technical assistance, you know, in every community you can think of around the state. So it's a very important service because there are other groups that are doing that kind of thing, but we're really the only one that's focused on an arts from the arts perspective.
So in terms of your legislative work, and you know, your talking points are, I guess it's called creative policy. Can you talk about your legislative work?
Yes. So we are a nonprofit, and we are an organization registered with the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. We have a contract lobbyist who we work with to educate and advocate with the legislature and with the administration. Wisconsin is woefully behind in terms of per capita funding of the arts on the public level. We have incredibly generous private donors, corporations, businesses, and Wisconsin does support the arts and creative industries in many ways. But in terms of per capita funding of our state arts council, we are bad. It's bad. We're 49th out of 50 states, and states around us, Minnesota being the most impressive one, they provide over $9 per capita when we're about 18 cents. And so that's, we're missing a huge opportunity to invest in our 21st century economy. So that's our message to the legislature. I can't say that we've gotten huge amounts of money. We got a little bit of money in the budget last year, which was a good step, but we certainly have been influencing hearts and minds for the last 10 years, and you know, we'll keep pushing forward. There will be a lot of changes, you know, in the legislature this year, and so we're revving up to. We can't endorse candidates because we're not a C4 organization, but we can educate people. We can educate candidates, and we can educate people about the importance of speaking up and about the importance of pushing the message that investment in the arts and creativity is critical to Wisconsin's future. So that's the work for the rest of the year and then into the state budget season next year.
Okay, I need those numbers again. 49th in the nation. So who's the only one that's worse than Wisconsin?
I think it's Georgia at the moment. Yeah, and there have been times when states have completely eliminated their state arts council, Kansas, or their funding for their arts council. Kansas did that a few years ago. So we're 49th out of 50 states in per capita funding with 18 cents per capita. And that's, you know, that's just not acceptable.
And so, as opposed to Minnesota, which was $9 per capita.
Yeah, Minnesota has something called the Legacy Amendment, which is a in 2008, the voters approved a constitutional amendment designating a portion of the sales tax for conservation, clean water, and the arts. And that actually was something that was tried in Wisconsin for a period of time. It hasn't really gone anywhere since, but it's certainly something that's out there. But that's why Minnesota, the voters provide that funding for the arts, again, and conservation and environmental efforts.
And we appreciate, I know you appreciate private donors, so that money is important to support work. But tell listeners why it's so important to have this inside of the state budget and the what that allows to flourish when we have state-funded creative policy.
I mean, the state will gains money the state invests in economic development, right? It invests in all sorts of different industries. It provides funding for different kinds of business development. The creative industries are an important business opportunity, and the state is missing a great opportunity to grow our economy, to make our communities more livable, to generate things like sales tax if we don't invest in the creative industries. So the private sector is incredibly generous and hopefully will continue to be, but they can't shoulder the burden alone. And our arts industries are incredibly creative and entrepreneurial and will continue to be so, but a little bit more investment would bring more growth. It's amazing what people are doing with not enough resources. And a little bit more funding to match what they raise on the local level and to what they do otherwise would go a long way. So, you know, the research shows that every dollar invested in the arts and creativity brings at least an $8 return. And if you look at our downtowns around the state, when you build an arts center, when you have an arts program, then everything else flourishes, right? Everything is connected to that art center or that program. And that's everything from hotels to restaurants to gas stations to, you know, all sorts of other businesses. So, I mean, the arts are the research has demonstrated that the arts are an important industry. And so that is the message that we're bringing to the legislature and to the governor. And I'd say that there's great understanding of that. You know, I sometimes say that I've been talking about the creative economy since the last millennium, which I have. And it's long ago that I got sort of blank stares. But now everybody sees that, and especially after the pandemic, our world is changing faster than we can keep up with it. And so we really need to and that we need to invest in our people, industries, and communities. So the change is happening slowly, too slowly, I think sometimes, but it is happening. And I there isn't anyone who doesn't understand that we need to do more along these lines.
And, you know, I'm thinking as you're speaking, the things like arts boards versus private funders, which we appreciate, they seed, I'm thinking, different kinds of fields, if you will, and that, you know, that can support then, artists and ideas that might not have yet even resonated with private donors' ideas.
Well, and I mean, the public money is meant to make things accessible, right? So the money that the Arts Board provides to support nonprofit ventures and arts programs goes to help make whatever that program is available to everyone in the community. And that's a huge, I mean, that is hugely important. If we relied on the price of a ticket for people to participate in the arts, there would be far fewer people who would be able to, to participate. And so when you look at events like the concerts on the square, all the festivals and fairs that we have in Madison and everywhere in the state, those are free to attend, but they are definitely not free to produce and to present. And so it's money from the Arts Board, from Dane Arts, from the Madison Arts Commission, entities like that, that make it possible for the price of a ticket to be as low as possible or for things to be free for people to attend. And so that's why public money is important. You know, if we didn't have funding from the Arts Board and from the city and the county going to the concerts on the square, you'd have to pay to get in, or for any of the festivals that we have on the east side or, you know, anywhere in the city. So that is really why the public money is so important, because it makes the arts accessible.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Ann Katz, Executive Director of Create Wisconsin, and the headline that Wisconsin is 49th in the nation on arts policy spending, 18 cents per capita compared to other folks in our region. Minnesota, $9. So, if folks want more information, they can log on to createwisconsin.org or give you a call.
Absolutely. And we have a big social media presence as well, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram. So, yes, please get in touch. I'd love to talk to anyone about how they can be advocates in the community and how to make things happen.
Thank you. And Create Wisconsin, a member agency of Community Shares of Wisconsin. Thanks, Anne. It was great to talk with you. Take care.
Thank you, Jan. I appreciate it.
It's just about 8:30. We'll take a short break. And then joining me will be Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott from the Brennan Center. So stay with us.
If anyone asks you how just say I'm doing fine. If you will do that for me, I'll do the same for you sometime. And if anyone asks you where I've gone, just say I'm down the line.
It's just about 8:31. That music is just a salve on my heart this morning, Dave. Joining me is Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott. She's senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice Judiciary Program, where she works to realize a fair and inclusive judicial system that protects fundamental rights, democratic values, and the rule of law. We need to say that. And we'll be talking about the need for judicial diversity this morning, and in particular, about the treatment of the first Muslim federal appellate nominee in the Third Circuit, Adil Mangi. So Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott says that insinuations during Mangi's confirmation process, so for instance, that Adil Mangi supports Islamic terrorism, along with attacks on his pro bono work, have no place in a society committed to justice and equality and has damaged our institutions. Questions during the confirmation hearing left an impression that religious and racial stereotypes had hijacked the hearings. And as it happens, just the latest appears that it could ultimately sink Adil Mangi's nomination. So I welcome Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott to talk about this need for judicial diversity and the happenings at this confirmation hearing and what it tells us. So good morning, Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott.
Good morning. Hi, how are you today?
Great. And, when I was reading your analysis piece at Brennan Center, I thought, this was, some folks are really following this. But in many ways, this is kind of below the radar, what's happened to Judge Adil Mangi. So can you first, from a higher altitude, do we have a problem with judicial diversity?
Well, absolutely. Historically, the federal bench has been made up mostly of white men. And it's not just about race and gender. It's also about professional background. A lot of corporate lawyers, a lot of former prosecutors. But I do want to start out sort of on a positive note. In the last few years, diversity is definitely increasing. Nearly two-thirds of the federal judges that President Biden has appointed so far are women, and nearly two-thirds are people of color. And the Senate just did their 100th confirmation of a woman of color to the federal bench just 3 weeks ago. So things are moving in the right direction.
And that's something that is a significant accomplishment of this current administration that we don't hear about. Why do you think that's important that this has happened? How does that make our system better?
Sure. So I'm just going to back up and explain sort of why federal courts matter, and in particular why appellate courts matter.
Yes.
So the Third Circuit Court of Appeals is the circuit to which this Mangi was nominated. The country is divided up into roughly 13 courts of appeals. Courts of appeals they're the final word on so many different issues because the U.S. Supreme Court is the only court above them. So if somebody loses below in the trial court, they take it to their court of appeals. And this could be issues from voting rights, discrimination, religious liberties, police practices, like you name it, thousands and thousands of cases end at the court of appeals. So the people who sit on that court really have a huge impact on people's lives. And we know that diversity on the bench leads to richer jurisprudence, as when you have people sitting there trying to figure out what is the right decision in a particular case on a particular issue, when they have different experiences, when they have different backgrounds, different ideas, they're much more likely to get to the right result. And they're likely to have an impact on each other. Sandra Day O'Connor said that Thurgood Marshall, who was the first Black Supreme Court justice, changed the way that she thought about the world very frequently. And so that leads to different outcomes. And moreover, legitimacy of the judiciary comes from public trust in the judiciary. Like, the only reason that the courts have the power that they have is because we trust them and we listen to them. And if these courts that are impacting our day-to-day lives don't reflect the diversity of this country, they lose legitimacy because people lose trust in them.
So then enter somebody like Adil Manji, can you tell us about this person, this nominee?
Sure. So Adil has a pretty actually run-of-the-mill background. He's Harvard-educated, Oxford and Harvard-educated. He worked at a corporate law firm for many years in New York City. He did a lot of pro bono work. I think that that's been one of the flashpoints in his nomination, that senators have really focused on his pro bono work, but they've painted it in a negative light rather than the positive light that I think that pro bono work deserves to be treated in. All attorneys have an ethical obligation to do pro bono work. A lot of people lose lawsuits that are meritorious because they have no lawyer. A great example is that with unaccompanied minors, when they are unrepresented, I think the stat is something like they're only allowed to stay in the country 13% of the time, as opposed to almost 75% of the time when they have attorneys. So really, our justice system really, really depends on people being represented. And people can't afford lawyers for the most part. You're only guaranteed a right to a lawyer if it's a criminal matter. For all of these other matters, people need to pay for lawyers, or they have to rely on public interest organizations or pro bono lawyers from corporate law firms to step up and do that work. And so Adil Manji did a lot of pro bono work, and his pro bono record has really been used against him.
And we'll circle back to that, but doing work for folks who might not be represented, like somebody who was incarcerated, those kinds of work. But so is he a naturalized American?
Manji is a U.S. citizen. He was born in Pakistan. I think he came over at the age of 22, something like that, and studied at Harvard before moving on to a law firm.
And that does not make him ineligible.
That's right.
So you described the hearings, it's not a statement about the Brennan Center supporting the nomination. It is what happened, and I wanted to have you discuss what happened. You call the confirmation process something of a grotesque spectacle.
Yes. Yeah, it was really, really sad to watch. We had a lot of senators asking him if he condemned the atrocities of the Hamas terrorists, if there were any justification for those atrocities. One senator asked him if he celebrated 9/11. It was sad. Like, I, as an American, as somebody who really cares about justice and inclusivity, one detail that really stuck out at me was that his young children were there watching. I could not imagine what that felt like for them. It was both parties asked these kinds of questions. On one side, the questions were hostile. On the other side, they were meant to sort of give him. When the Democrats had the floor, they revisited those questions, trying to give him an opportunity to sort of fully condemn terrorism, which he did unequivocally. But even then, it just the fact that these topics kept coming up, it really left a listener or a viewer with like a gross feeling about our country and where. The fact that the first ever Muslim American nominee to a federal appellate bench was up there and just nonstop being peppered with questions about whether or not he supports terrorism, even if the questions were sort of a friendly format to allow him to obviously say that he does not, it really felt shameful.
And you were critical. When you say this kind of friendly form of everyone that, including how the Democrats came back to this topic of Manji having to denounce terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't imagine being in Manji's shoes, having been, he's an American, I'm not commenting on whether or not they should confirm him, but he has been rated qualified. He's by the ABA. His background is just like pretty standard, and just to keep having to come back and keep having to say these things that we all feel. Which, yes, yes, I condemn terrorism in all of its forms. It must have been extremely exhausting, and not just for him, but I imagine how our Muslim friends and neighbors feel watching this, especially in a time when Islamophobia and hate crimes against all groups are on the rise. I just think it's a really damaging and scary line of questioning to be engaged in.
In your piece, you quote CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women saying it was a, quote, heartbreaking scene for the first Muslim American Federal Circuit judicial nominee to face relentless questioning on Israel, terrorism, including September 11th and the Holocaust.
I'm so sorry. I was just going to say that these questions have been really condemned sort of across the board by groups of all backgrounds, all religious persuasions, et cetera.
And you know, I was reading other news reporting on this nomination because, in fact, it could be tanked because of all of this Islamophobia. But people who chime in on nominations like this are groups that are supporting the nomination are like the Anti-Defamation League and groups that would counter any suggestion about this, about Adil Mangi.
Yeah, that's right. He has garnered a lot of support, including from many, many Jewish groups who I think were rightly horrified to see to see his religion being used against him. I think that I think Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, et cetera, hurts all of us. It doesn't just hurt the people that it's directed against.
Now, you write, circling back to the pro bono work, you write that pro bono records by nominees are often that can be, you say, criminal adjacent. The twisting of those happens, right? Especially with people of color and women. They're routinely grilled.
That's right. There does seem to be, especially in recent history, kind of a fixation on trying to use the public records of, in particular, nominees who would increase the diversity on the federal bench against them. We've seen it in multiple confirmation hearings where people who, for example, women and women of color in particular, who worked as public defenders, being told that they, you know, devoted their entire lives to representing murderers and rapists. Somebody who's now on the bench who used to work at the Innocence Project, Nina Morrison, was told that any increase in crime was a direct result of the what the issues that she had devoted her career to, sort of putting aside the fact that the word innocence is in the name of the organization, Innocence Project. So it's hard to sort of understand what the through line is there between not incarcerating innocent people and an increase in crime. But it's become increasingly common that public service and pro bono work is being twisted to suggest that people are soft on crime, that nominees are soft on crime.
Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott, this piece is really well. I like this piece. It's easy to understand. And you just sum it up really clearly. You said with Mangi's hearings, senators are yet again issuing bad faith characterizations of the public interest work of a nominee who would increase the diversity of the federal bench. I think that is exactly what you're saying there. And then you also were, you know, just bullying, you say, of a prominent Muslim American on the national stage. That's just a bad message, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, we are an extremely diverse country, and we want everybody to feel represented. We want everybody to feel like they can take part equally in running our country. And just the message that this sends, who would want to be next? If I were a Muslim lawyer with aspirations for the federal bench and I watched this, I would think twice about trying to pursue that path. And that's very sad.
It is very, you know, and it appears, I've been reading the latest, that three Democrats have sort of dropped their support for this nomination and could very likely just not be, Adil Mangi might not be confirmed. Do you have any on that, news on that?
You know, as I've said, we at the Brennan Center, we don't take positions on individual nominees, but we do talk about the process. Mm-hmm. So I can't take a position on whether or not they should vote to confirm him. But I should say that the reasons that have been put forth for why they are doubting him are not the kinds of reasons that I think ultimately are good for justice, justice and equality and inclusion. A lot of the justifications for their lack of support has been because of his association with a criminal justice group that works on behalf of incarcerated people, or rather advocates on behalf of families of incarcerated people. Those kinds of organizations are really, really important in our justice system. And I don't think that lawyers should be maligned, or that it should be a political liability if you do work with some of our most disfavored citizens. I mean, even people behind bars have constitutional rights, and the federal constitution does guarantee a minimum level of treatment behind bars. And we need lawyers willing to step up and take on those cases if somebody has been brutalized behind bars. They don't have a right to counsel. So really a lot of those cases are brought as pro bono cases by lawyers who do other things. And it's very important to filling that access to justice gap.
Thank you. I'm Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott, Senior Counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice Judiciary Program. And look for her analysis piece at the Brennan Center website. I also direct listeners to a piece that came out just a couple of days ago at Slate. Look for the piece by Shirin Ali. This is a crucial moment to stand up to Islamophobia. Instead, Democrats are caving. So take a look at that as well. Thank you, Kasia. For joining me this morning, Kasia Zimborski-Wolfcott. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's 8:47, and I think we've got Lindsay Kashgarian on the line. Thank you for standing by, Lindsay. Lindsay is the program director at the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, where they fight for a federal budget that prioritizes peace, economic security, and shared prosperity. And each year they produce a tax receipt that shows where your 2023 income taxes went. And so I'm just glad to have Lindsay on this morning. Tax day came in the 15th has passed. Lindsay, thanks for joining me to talk about the tax receipt.
Thanks for having me, Jan.
Hey, so Lindsay, in 2023, the average taxpayer subsidized corporate contractors that were contracted inside of the military budget. Is that just a good place to start? And then we'll contrast, what we could have, or not what we could have, how much we spent on something else compared to that.
Yes. So we calculate a tax receipt for how much your federal income taxes support. And for the average taxpayer in 2023, they gave $1,748 to Pentagon contractors. So corporations, these are weapons makers. They're sometimes IT companies. They're, anything you can think of. The Pentagon contracts out typically over half of its budget each year. And so this is a huge contribution that all of us as taxpayers are making to these corporations that profit from the Pentagon and profit from the Pentagon budget and from our wars. And so that $1,700 that the average taxpayer gave to these Pentagon contractors is more than the average monthly rent in the U.S.
And just looking at here, the shareholders for these contractors were enriched by 73%. So this was 73% is really rich.
So we are a part of that $1,700 is that we are all funding. We're funding dividends, which is the shareholders. We're funding stock buybacks, which these companies do, even though some of them are getting you know, upwards of 80 or 90% of their revenues from the federal government. They're essentially extensions of the federal government, but they're still allowed to make these profits and to do things like stock buybacks that are just building up the price of their own stocks. And that's part of what our fat tax dollars are funding.
And that's just a piece of the tax receipt that goes to these kinds of, to militarism, correct?
Yes. So that is just one piece of what goes to militarism. What we calculated is that the average taxpayer was paying over $5,000, $5,109 to militarism. And so that includes the Pentagon and Pentagon contractors. It includes the support systems for militarism. So while we might not want to spend less on veterans programs, that it includes those because the reason they're necessary is because we have so many people who we've sent into harm's way as part of the military. It includes mass incarceration, federal prisons, and law enforcement. And it includes our massive Homeland Security system, which is responsible for deportations and detentions and our inhumane treatment of immigrants and immigrant communities. So all of that is included in militarism, and the average taxpayer paid over $5,000 for all of that, which, you know, for most of us is quite a bit of money.
Now, compare that to other priorities.
Yeah, so militarism is one of the biggest segments.
Or non-priorities.
yes. So when we think about, you know, paying $1,700 for Pentagon contractors, and that included $249 for just Lockheed Martin, which is the biggest Pentagon contractor. So if you think about $249, and then we kind of look at some of the other expenses, for example, you know, most of us understand at this point that climate change is one of the biggest threats that we face. And so we're paying $249 to a single Pentagon contractor, but the average taxpayer is only paying $10.84 for energy efficiency and renewable energy programs. So that is a huge disparity. And it's not just that we're giving so much money to military and military contractors who are, you know, who are engaging in wars and feeding conflicts around the world and making the world more dangerous. It's also that this is taking money away from priorities that we desperately need to fund, like climate change. So that $11, if you think about that, about how little that is compared to the scope of the challenge of climate change, those are the kinds of comparisons that we make.
How much, comparatively speaking, does the tax bill go for things like diplomacy as opposed to militarism?
Yeah, so diplomacy, of course, is our major alternative to conflict and war, right? And that's where we want to see diplomacy preventing conflicts and preventing wars. So another comparison is that out of that militarism budget, the average taxpayer gave $112 for foreign militaries. And that was dominated last year by military aid to Ukraine and military aid to Israel. For its assault on Gaza. So these are things that the vast majority of Americans do not support those things at all, let alone, you know, giving them their own tax dollars for them. So $112 for foreign militaries and just $58 for diplomacy that could end these conflicts or could prevent other conflicts and that could, you know, address all sorts of other challenges, including there's a lot of climate diplomacy that we need. There's a lot of conflicts diplomacy that we need, of course. There's trade diplomacy that we need to help with, you know, job creation and protecting the ability of the American economy to support and uphold people. So all of that has to fall into that $58. It's just minuscule compared to the amount that we spent on militarism.
You mentioned Lockheed Martin. You also pull out the data on Boeing and compare what they get compared to the FAA.
Yes. So everyone's seen the news about Boeing. It's been ongoing. There keeps being new developments over the last few years. First, it was planes crashing, and then it was planes falling apart in midair. And there have been whistleblower reports recently that additional Boeing planes were not properly put together, and stories of things like contractors literally jumping on plane parts in order to get them to fit into where they were supposed to go in order to change the shape. So Boeing has had huge problems on its commercial airline side, but Boeing is also one of the top five Pentagon contractors. And so the average taxpayer gave $87 to Boeing for Pentagon contracts, but only $23. So, you know, a factor of several times, only $23 for the Federal Aviation Administration, which is the regulatory agency that's responsible for commercial airline safety. So all of this money is going to the company, Boeing, that's responsible for these failures and that is providing weapons to and weapon systems and aircraft to the Pentagon. And just very little money, only $23 going to the FAA that's responsible for keeping us all safe when we fly.
You know, this... Well, I'm just going to keep going through the receipt and then we'll react to it. What about education? What National Priorities Project is looking at federal taxes, what the average taxpayers, taxpayer paid for. And so these are things that the federal government can help subsidize and support in our states. States often spend additional amounts of money. But what about education?
Yes. So we look at education. We look at K-12 education is of particular interest. And of course, all of us pay local taxes that are supporting our local school systems as well. So the federal government is only one source of funding for our public schools. But it's a really important source because it's the source that helps even the playing field even a little bit. You know, local funding for public schools is a notorious problem because it means that rich areas have lots of funding for schools and poor areas have very little funding for schools. And so that perpetuates inequality. And the federal government is our main way for equalizing that and federal aid to public schools. So the average taxpayer gave $346 for public K-12 education, which doesn't sound terrible until you remember that we're giving almost $3,000 for the Pentagon. So it's a huge disparity. Obviously, we need public education and we want to help even out those inequalities so that poor students have an equal opportunity in public schools. And right now it's especially important because public schools are receiving additional COVID aid that has ended. And a lot of school districts are cutting their budgets. My school district right now is cutting its budget and expecting to let go of, you know, people who are positions that are working directly with students, which is one of the worst things we can do for our public schools. So the fact that we're spending almost 10 times as much on the Pentagon as we are on public education, obviously those priorities are not what's going to make our country stronger.
So Lindsay, when you're talking with your friends or colleagues, and you react to these findings on the tax receipt, like, what do you tell them?
You know, we talk about, it's interesting because people have so many different feelings about paying taxes. Mm-hmm. Most people don't particularly like it, although many people do feel like it's an important responsibility. Yes. And so what I talk about is really that that our taxes are supporting good things and bad things, and that the important thing is that we should be making sure that our members of Congress know what we want those taxes to be supporting, and that we want our taxes to support things like public education or clean energy, and we don't want our taxes supporting things like wars and conflicts and weapons and contractors.
Thank you. I'm speaking with Lindsay Kashgarian. Look for her pieces at the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's a program director there. Thank you, Lindsay, for speaking with me this morning. It was great to have you on and to hear from you.
Thanks, Jan.
And thank you, Dave Lawrenson, our music producer and engineer this morning. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I'll talk with you next week.
And it's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison. Coming up next, Surgeon Radio Kiosk, and then back to the country, so stay tuned.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, April 17th.
If you think the GOP's Congress of Clowns represents the fringiest, freakiest pack of politicos that MAGA world can hurl at us, you haven't been to Texas. It's widely known, of course, that Ted Cruz, Greg Abbott, and most other top Republican officials here are obsequious Trump acolytes. Thus, Texas is infamously racing against Florida to be declared the stupidest, meanest, most repressive state government in America, constantly making demonic attacks on women's freedom, immigrants, voting rights, public schools, poor people, and so on. But I'm confident Texas will win this race to the bottom for one big reason. GOP crazy runs extraordinarily deep here. We have a county-level layer of ultra-MAGA cultists constantly pressing the state's far-right officials to march all the way to the farthest edge of extremism, then leap into absurdity. Therefore, the party officially supports abolishment of labor unions, elimination of the minimum wage, privatization of Social Security, legalization of machine guns, and, well, you get the drift. Now, though, local mad dog Trumpistas are pushing their party straight into the abyss of autocracy by declaring war on HEB. What's that? HEB is a Texas chain of supermarkets beloved in communities throughout our state. Beloved because the stores fully embrace the diversity of all people, has affordable prices, values employees, and supports community needs. Nonetheless, county Republican zealots screech that HEB violates their party ideology by accepting food stamps, opposing privatization of schools, and sponsoring some LGBTQ pride events. So they're demanding official condemnation of the grocery chain for